It's The Wonky Show, a new era of collaboration from UUK's Efficiency Task Force. They've got a report out. Research England's EDI action plan is out as well. And does our degree model harm students' health? It's all coming up.
If a three-year undergrad was a physical activity measured on Strava or with a Garmin watch, it would say, this is high pressure, high intensity, avoid doing this activity because it's not good for you. When the stats tell us it's not good for you.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us understand and make sense of what on earth is going on, as usual, three top-line guests. In Durham, Riley Rapa is Associate Professor in Sociology in Higher Education at Durham University. Riley, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight is actually work-related. So we just launched a new research project. So this is a collaborative work with Rachel Brooks from Oxford and Tom Fryer from Manchester. And we will be looking at whether higher education has any impact on students' political knowledge, views and behaviours. So watch this space.
It's a very exciting project, that. Link to details of the launch there in the show notes. In London, Jess Lister is Director of Education at Public First. Jess, your highlight of the week, please.
Hello, Jim. My highlight of the week, I got to go and put my skills hat on yesterday and talk all about the government's skills policy and why I think skills doesn't exist yesterday, which was a huge amount of fun. And we are now gearing up for the spending review next week.
Great stuff. And in Fort William this week, Mac Marshall is Community and Policy Officer at Wonky. Mac, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is it is the last week of my brother's exams at college, so hopefully he'll be a little bit less stressed going forward.
Fantastic stuff. Now, we start this week with collaboration and efficiency. UUK's Efficiency and Transformation Task Force unveiled its first report this week, Mac. What was in it?
So, yes, Universities UK's Efficiency and Transformation Task Force has published their first report about how universities can work together. And this is about kind of saving cash, so looking at efficiencies, but also coming up with a few new business models. A lot of this work tracks back to Universities UK's blueprint from September last year, and it's about universities making efficiencies and then expecting the government to provide some sort of level of support in response. The report calls for collaboration primarily. It's thinking about how can universities and other providers work together, but also how can the government and the regulator or the regulators make it easier for that collaboration to happen. They're basically telling government, look, we're ready. We're ready for transformation. We want to move quicker on this, but they want a vision and a plan from government, with ideally a bit of cash to help that happen. So it identifies about seven different opportunities to open to the sector and some action needed from government to drive that change. And these are things like, again, collaboration, the sharing of services, digital transformation, and thinking in the context here as well about kind of cold spots in subject provision, but also developing business cases for shared initiatives, approach to supporting ongoing collaboration from government and from regulators, and also the government removing things like VAT restrictions.
Well, fascinating stuff. Now, really, the report, before we get into it, I guess, the report basically has quite a few pot shots at the Higher Education Research Act's kind of focus on competition. Is collaboration the antidote to all of the sector's challenges?
Look, Jim, it's really interesting because I was looking at this report with curiosity. So first of all, who wouldn't want to speak about collaboration instead of competition? And I do think, in all honesty, that collaboration is going to be the buzzword of this year. It seems to be popping up everywhere. Now, I suppose my question is that what does this report even mean by collaboration? Because I was looking at it and I was trying to understand that, you know, who was even involved in producing this report beyond the task force. So that was one side, that it mentioned, you know, interviews with academics potentially, but doesn't say how many within that 70. There was no mention of students. So I wondered who kind of is imagining this new vision of collaboration. And then I suppose, you know, going back to what the report does well for me is actually giving a really good analysis of the current state of higher education. It does that so well that I thought I'm going to use this with my students who are studying higher education topics. So that's the good thing, but that's where it stays for me. I can tell you a little bit more what my issues are, but I'm just really, really skeptical whether the competition, how it's used in this report, sorry, collaboration, how it's used in this report actually means the collaboration that we want, or is it in a kind of very strange, unequal starting point when we have to force failing institutions to collaborate in a really unequal kind of position.
Yeah, so the almost the kind of before it gets into whatever it might do, the framing is kind of interesting. So look, Jess, shared back office services. I mean, you know, I've heard this a million times over the years. Shared back office and sort of shared teaching provision both get a sort of, you know, get mentioned. Is it going to happen? Are these realistic given, you know, the sort of cultures we have in the UK and all the competitive pressures? And
I think they're going to have to happen. But I think this report is the sort of starting gun of what has been a Mexican standoff between the sector and government, where the government hasn't really given the sector the funding it needs to keep delivering the education product at the quality it has done in the past. So universities are having to change the product. And this isn't like the sort of quality streets you get at Christmas where you can just put, you know, fewer chocolates in the tin and sell it at the same price. You know, students demand and expect the same experience this year as they probably would have got 2 years ago or 5 years ago, and government expects universities to deliver it. So we're in a world in which everyone is going to have to try and do things differently. And what government has made very, very clear is that it needed to see this report and it needed to see this work and it needed to see these ideas before it would even consider sort of changing the funding settlement. I actually thought there's a lot in here that was like really interesting and seemingly really obvious. I mean, I haven't worked in a university for a long time, but I remember how often this type of collaboration felt like a good thing to do and also an impossible thing to do. And I think it's, you know, if you're people as weird as us, it's quite exciting to sort of enter a world in which universities are considering, as you say, better and more ways of working together. And I really liked UK's framing of this about, you know, this is how we tackle some of the cold spots in provision that will pop up otherwise. It's by sort of universities working together in areas. This is how we make sure the teaching offer stays the same by making efficiencies elsewhere and sort of, you know, covering costs elsewhere. But it's a necessary, not sufficient report. And I think it's back to government now to sort of make the next move to see if they can help the sector as it enters this sort of new era.
Mac, I guess, you know, I would say this, wouldn't I? But, you know, kind of riffing to some extent off some of the stuff Rilo was saying, I can't really find students in here. And I'm not saying that from a tokenistic point of view. When FE was kind of dragooned into doing area reviews, and a lot of those area reviews then led to things that are in this report, right? Things like federation models and group structures. Hell of a lot of FE colleges are now in, you know, what are basically FE college multi-academy trusts, right? But students, both through NUS and locally, played a really, really important role in kind of shaping some of the decisions and so on. So students just aren't in here, are they? Or have I just skim read it?
No, I think this presents to me as a bit of a flag-waving exercise of like going to DfE and saying, look, we're doing something. This is one of your priorities. This is what you said back in the day when you increased fees. We're going to look at collaboration. Please help give us some money to do it. And it starts to feel more like a sticking plaster under the pretense of we're thinking about cold spots and student choice, but actually that doesn't seem like it's at the forefront. It seems like kind of stopping a sinking ship rather than kind of building a better one. The one thing I would like to think about, and I'm trying to be in my optimistic era at the moment, is collaboration could actually like enhance the student experience a little bit. If you're thinking about students having access to more shared services, like, you know, using more than one library or more than one sports facility, or, you know, access to a decent student record system if universities share them, like there's an opportunity here to kind of enhance it a little bit. And, you know, Jim, when we get on a bus and go around Europe, there's so many examples where students can do like an entire semester at another institution. In Poland, they've got that Polish Erasmus scheme where they do a semester at another economics college. And I think that's good for two reasons. One is obviously you've got access to more resources and more tools, and ideally you're not losing the value for money there. Actually, maybe you're enhancing it. But also my other always side tangent there is the more that students experience different types of quality of education, the better they can evaluate it as well.
Yeah, well, so yeah, maybe some opportunities will come up kind of further in the process. I don't know. I mean, really, the report also, I guess, talks about this cold spot thing and vulnerable disciplines and so on. One of the things I guess that worries me about that whole thing is we don't really have a lot of data on what is currently being deleted, what's currently being locked. You know, there isn't a database or a report on how cold some of the cold spots are getting, you know, from a particular subject point of view or whatever. So, you know, is this managed decline by another name, or is this, you know, is this a serious, look, we do want to address this, we just need a hand?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point. And even, you know, academics like myself, we don't have a real sense of what are those so-called cold spots and where are we losing out? You know, one could guess, you know, within the era that we live that, you know, where the neoliberal beast just shapes everything, that it's probably going to be the typical, you you know, the kind of the soft subjects that are going to lose out, and the ones that are contributing into the government's, you know, the industrial and industry agendas, that's where perhaps some of that growth will go. So I do think we have to be really careful in terms of thinking about as well that where will students lose out? And also the same way, you know, universities in general. But, you know, Jim, if I can, I'll go back to also, and I might be just a cynical academic, you know, and you guys might know better, but I'm just also thinking about reading this report that who is shaping this agenda? Because, you know, when I was reading this report, there were so many similarities with some of the other reports that have come out recently. You know, the one that JISC did with KPMG, which was very much about the collaboration for tech things. Then the one even that you guys in Wonky did with Mills and Reeve. And then I was looking at the, you know, the report and acknowledgements at the very end where we thank KPMG, BWC, Mills and Reeve, Lloyds Banking and so on. So I'm just wondering as well the extent to which, you know, that agenda and the ways in which we speak about collaboration is not really actually coming from universities or certainly not from academic and student communities. And there is this kind of private sector that feeds into how we think about infrastructure sharing and so on. And it probably isn't all bad, but I'm wary and I'm thinking about that the ways in which we think about also courses and subjects that are probably somehow different from what the, you know, the university communities would speak about anyhow.
I guess if nothing else, even if, you know, the sort of collaboration that emerges is very sort of back office-y and infrastructure-y, then, you know, if suddenly you're saying to someone, well, you've got to fill this form differently, they're much more likely to be happy about it if they've been involved in the process, aren't they? But Jess, one of the things I was going to ask you was, am I losing it, right? Like we are in the middle of about to implement with, you know, with quite heavy, you know, quite heavy push from government, the LLE. Can it be the case that this report doesn't mention collaboration on student records or student credit or academic credit or module credit or European credit system? How is it that almost every other European country, me and Mac have visited or me and Livia have visited in the past 5 years, has got a shared student record system and we're about to implement an LLE, but this doesn't mention that opportunity?
Look, we are so far off the system you imagine, Jim, right? The sort of credit transfer one in which the LLE exists and works and is in its pilot phase. And I maybe care a bit less about some of those longer term changes, because I think what everyone needs to see is the change that happens like right now. We keep oscillating between the sector being in dire straits crisis and a bit fine. It feels like we're in a bit fine era now, but it wasn't that long ago we were publishing reports about, you know, what happens when an institution goes bust completely. So I think this is sort of, you know, fix the broken window, then put the double glazing in. And I think, you know, I would love, as you say, a sort of entirely reimagined system in which there's easy credit transfer and you can bop between institutions across your life and, you know, that all works seamlessly. I don't think that's the problem that this paper was trying to solve. I think this was more about, you know, right now, immediately, as we're all undergoing, you know, I can't remember what the latest count was for sort of universities making redundancies and dropping headcount and dropping departments, but it was much higher than it was 12 months ago. And it comes back a little bit to Riley's point. Like, the British Academy's put out a really good report about shape cold spots. So, you know, humanities and arts subjects where there are areas of the country it's really hard to access those. There's also increasingly areas of the country you can't do a maths degree anymore. If you talk to the sort of pure maths people, they're really worried about that as well. And, you know, we think about this a lot at provider level, and we need to be thinking again about the sort of regional level impact of this. I'm not going to start advocating for sort of the state plan of higher education. But there is a world in which this sort of decline isn't managed. We're going to wake up in 5 years' time with a bunch of areas of the country where it's really hard to do lots of different types of degrees and no one really noticed and put all those pieces together.
But really, isn't the point here, right, that if this report is only about that sort of, oh my God, we're about to run out of money, is there a way for us to jointly buy a thing, right? Rather than actually one of the ways that we can save money and deliver on the government's wider priorities is through collaboration that both saves money and reimagines the way you deliver higher education. Don't you have to do the second one? Because it just feels to me like that the opportunity costs when everyone is kind of really at the edge of running out of money are so high that even with some government support, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, how a cold spot becomes warmer.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in my opinion, collaboration is almost like a marriage, isn't it? In a way that you should start from the position of strength rather than, you know, we have no other option than we now need to, I don't know, get married or collaborate. So, yeah. So, and then somebody will win in this situation, isn't it? That somebody will, and that's, I do think that it's what it will do is reorganize some of that market competition. There will be, again, winners and losers in a way that who wins from those collaborative partnerships. But again, you know, I don't want to be overly cynical because there have been examples. Wasn't the BBC article speaking about the student who, you know, the pharmacy program between Bath and Plymouth, I think, and the ways in which it makes certain courses for some students more accessible. And I'm not arguing against that, but that probably, I don't know how that came about, but my question is, are we starting to imagining those new things from the position of strength or from the position of weakness? And if it is from the position of weakness, there are so many risks of things going badly, isn't it? So that's why what I'm kind of slightly worried about, but I guess we'll watch and see. But also how many reports we have read and nothing much changes. So I don't know.
The only thing I was going to say is like, where does this, what happens next? And Relay's already kind of mentioned this, is we're waiting on this summer attempt at a white paper on HE reform. And there's an expectation that some money will come with that from the spending review. But how quick is this transformation going to take place? And as you mentioned earlier, Jim, how quickly is that going to happen with students at the table? Because it's only getting worse. The sector is in dire straits. At what point are we going to start moving towards collaboration? What are those different phases? Because it's all well and good kind of thinking about this hypothetically. And as we want to, we want to think about it from a position of strength. But the practical next steps need to start happening very, very soon, or else it was a waste of time in the first place.
Jess, I've got one final question on this for you, which is, and you know, actually, back to the Europe thing, in all seriousness, right? One of the things that is characteristic of the types of kind of major collaboration projects that I've seen, you know, get kind of European ministers, you know, push over the past few years is characterized by what I would call a bit more grit, right? So, for example, I know it's only small, but in Latvia, towards the end of last year, the minister stands up and says, I want it to be possible for students to accrue credit from at least two institutions during their undergraduate program. Now, the point about that is, didn't say how, or, you know, here's all the, you know, here's the specific things that you need to do. But it was a really clear piece of direction from ministers. And isn't part of the problem here that ministers just, you know, they say words like collaboration, but aren't really getting a grip on the problems they want solved? And then UK doesn't really know either. So everyone kind of dances around each other and no one has a really clear agenda on what we're trying to achieve it.
It's a much bigger problem, right? Which is that no one thinks about higher education at all, apart from when they have to, and they do it with a bit of a sigh and an eye roll. And
Or when the Telegraph phone.
Yeah, so either a newspaper makes government think about this, or a vice chancellor makes them think about it. And I don't know if either of those are desirable, because what you don't have that I can see anywhere in government is a person who is interested in higher education reform in the same way that we all are, right? They don't exist in the DfE team. They don't exist in the sort of number 10 policy team. You actually have the opposite. You have lots of people that are quite sceptical and tired of higher education and they want to reform other things. Again, you know, skills, colleges, apprenticeships.
Free school meals
today. You know, Keir Starmer has sort of gone out on Sky this week and said, you know, Labour hasn't recognised young people who want an alternative university and that's what they're going to tackle. So the sort of grand plan that we want and that we've had previously, right? Previous governments have gone in and said, we want to tackle higher education and we want to resolve it in these ways. At the minute, you have a complete absence of their thinking about it. And I think I do feel for UUK because they are trying to do that in a void, but they're trying to do it as a member organisation, corralling 143 odd universities together to come up with the answer. And if this is the starting point, then I don't know if it's a bad one.
Great. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Mark Bennett of Fine University and Keystone Education Group. And this week on Wonky, along with the University of Edinburgh's Ewan Fairweather, I've been thinking about potholes in postgraduate funding and what they look like from a student point of view. We've been asking whether it's fair that someone from England who works during a master's in Scotland can potentially lose access to PhD loan funding if their residency changes. We've been pondering whether someone should really be locked out of student finance for a master's in data science because they self-funded one in Gothic literature 15 years ago. And we've been questioning why it is that postgraduates get no form of childcare grant despite being more likely to have children. We think it's important that professionals in the PG space see these problems from a student perspective. If we can't fix the system, we can at least do our best to guide people through it.
Now, next up, Research England's Expert Advisory Group on EDI has published an action plan. Jess, what's going on here?
Yes, it has. I don't know if a sort of research council publishing a plan would usually make it onto the podcast, but it's worth remembering that about 2 years ago, this particular expert advisory group suspended and Michelle Donnellan launched her War on Woke in Science. And 2 years later, sort of from the ashes, Research England has come back and sort of published its action plan for equality and diversity and inclusion. We've got a whole new government now and a whole new plan for how EDI can be embedded in strategic research funding, some work on sort of new evidence that can be collected, how to add this into knowledge exchange, how to support EDI work in postgraduate research programs, and sort of have we turned over a new leaf where EDI is back on the agenda. Two final things, I guess, to flag to open this up into a bigger conversation. You know, if you look over in the US, EDI is having a very different moment than we are having in the UK, or it seems to be sort of flying a little bit under the radar. And there's a really interesting article this week by Sonia Soda about whether the sort of American turn, the sort of populist assault on universities is coming this way or not, and whether the sort of future of EDI work is going to continue to be a contested space or be a space where good people can get good work done and crack on with it.
Really, the danger of always coming to you with the, you know, let's think about this symbolically and politically before we think about the detail, but nevertheless, right? You know, Jess makes a really interesting point, I think, because, you know, as you know, this is the group that Michelle Donnellan suspended, as Jess says, but one of the things that strikes me is, although the government has said the culture wars, particularly in HE actually, are over, what it's also simultaneously absolutely not doing is saying initiatives like this are great news. It's kind of just running and hiding under some coats. Now, you know, is that a long-term problem, or is that just kind of fine for the political moment, you think?
It's super interesting. And I'm obviously an outsider. I've lived in the UK for 15 or a little bit longer. And for me, all of that is so un-British. I mean, I struggle to follow that because I think we don't usually get into stuff like that here, those kinds of wars, but maybe that's, you know, where the world is going. This report, an action plan or whatever we call it, this is a real good reflection of it. It's incredibly modest. It's super conservative. It says something, but doesn't really. So it's doing the aspect what it needs to do. And my reading of it is that it's actually part of our preparation for the REF 2029. Because if people, culture and environment is a big chunk of the ways in which public money is allocated to universities through QR funding, then they needed to do something like that. And obviously, whatever happened with the previous advisory group, that's almost, you can see it's bleeding through, that it's so modest. But I'm thinking about the two things that this little action plan does, or my reading of it is that one is that it really kind of tries to, in a very conservative, modest way, emphasize that diversity, inclusion, and so on should be embedded within the publicly funded research. Okay, that's one thing. But the other thing that it tries to do is it really is engineering those new forms of accountability measures to actually then look at whether, you know, the publicly funded research, what impact or what kind of stats, EDI stats could we attach to it? And I'm thinking that probably it's the focus on the second aspect that is the key, that it's another kind of accountability measure to look into EDI data. And that's where you can depoliticize certain things, because you then speak about, you know, let's look at numbers, you know, the diversity numbers from researchers who have been involved and so on. And I think it feeds into really to that people, culture, environment aspect of REF 2029. So if that aspect goes ahead as we think it does, we really, all universities need to be thinking in those terms. So I think, you know, I suppose in short, I wonder whether this little piece is trying to depoliticize some of that.
Yeah, sort of, to some extent, rolls the pitch for. Jess, one of the things that, I'm actually still on Twitter, although I don't really post there anymore. And you know, some people from the kind of Academics for Academic Freedom group, those types of academics that, there are groups, and then, they will write to the government and so on. You know, one of them, for example, yesterday said, the action plan is clear about the ultimate vision, a diverse and inclusive research and knowledge exchange system. What is missing? A commitment to excellence, quality, or merit. The EDI action report seems to be a decision to take money away from research and ring fence it for EDI. Now, that is it possible to depoliticize that, in the way that the action plan does? Or are we just now kind of stuck, even if the culture wars don't get picked up by ministers, in this kind of endless, this is the opposite of excellence, type debate? Are we stuck there?
The language of EDI and people who sort of work in it a lot and sort of make a good positive job and contribution out of this, sometimes forget to say the really obvious bits out loud. So why do we have an EDI action plan? It's because we know and we can evidence that having diverse people working in research and diverse ways of thinking and a focus on this makes our research better. You actually get better quality research if you do these things, so you don't have to trade off the two against each other. But sometimes I get a little bit sort of exasperated because everyone forgets to say that bit and they forget to evidence it and they forget to sort of, you don't have to pit this as two different things, right? You can either have diverse science or you can have good science, or you can have, research that is inclusive, or you can have bad research, We're actually everyone is trying to do the same thing here. And we're in a world where they are oppositional and there are people who are very quick and eager to sort of pull down EDI to push up their own agenda. I think it's on the sort of, the sort of other side of that, the people that do think this is really, really important. You have to make the positive case for it. You can't always make the defensive case for it. Otherwise, we're never going to get out of this trap where it's a sort of deepest, a constantly sort of political battle.
I think the context around this is probably the most interesting for me. And you've already touched on this, Jim, about kind of the culture wars are over. But to me, they're not. Like, we spend a lot of our time, Jim, chatting to SUs about all things policy. And one of the big things in the last round of calls was all about Sussex and the free speech ruling, and then also the Supreme Court ruling on the definition of a woman. And all of that animosity, that culture, that discourse, whatever you want to call it, has led to, when we've been speaking to student unions, a lot of either the SU or the university very, very quickly deleting their EDI policy off the website and going away and editing it and making sure it's compliant or whatever. And of course they should do that. Like, of course that's important. But there's a fear that in response to this kind of the culture war not actually being over, that people backtrack on EDI and they don't kind of stand firm and in their place. And that's why I quite like this Research England stuff, because actually it feels like something from 4 or 5 years ago where people are committing to EDI values and saying, it does lead to a more diverse knowledge exchange framework and so on and so forth. And saying it like it's not a big deal and like it's the standard. And that's kind of that's the culture and the rhetoric I want to kind of return to, rather than this divisive space we feel like we're in right now.
I'll tell you one of the things I did notice, really, was under a couple of the objectives, I think it's objective 2, action 5, that's it, in my kind of scribbled notes. It talks about working with OFS to maximise the impact of the PGR programme. And one of the things it says is it wants to embed EDI across the sector and improve access and participation for underrepresented Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups in postgraduate research, which sounds pretty good. But OFS never does anything on postgraduates access at all, does it? Or have I missed something?
No, I think that is super interesting, and that caught my attention as well. So that maybe it will feed into some of the work moving forward. But I did notice, I was exactly thinking that the BGRs were, but I guess because it's a Research England thing, that they have to say something about BGRs as well under the thing. But yeah, who is in charge? Who is, in the previous conversation, who is offering that stewardship that is lacking?
Because Jess, ultimately, a lot of EDI stuff, it's not necessarily about, tone or harassment or decolonizing the curriculum or whatever. It's about people. And, frequently one of the things people, were talking about when there was lots of debate a few years ago out the back of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter was the kind of pipeline. Like, if lots of the academics are, white, white and lots of the students are black, it takes a while to kind of influence the pipeline. But if there isn't anyone actually causing there to be, for example, some access and participation planning into PGT and then PGR, it never changes, does it?
Yeah, you're right. And I think, again, it's about like articulating why we think these things are important. There has never really been an access and participation plan that got to postgrad. We sort of do it at undergrad and then we forgot about it. But now we're in a world in which way more people are going on to master's level study. And it's good and right that we're thinking about the diversity of that and that there are people who are spending time and money on working on all of those things. And it's, you know, we don't want to get into a world in which we look up one day and all of our researchers look the same and think the same and are producing the same research because we've lost something there. But I think it's sort of not getting lost in the plans and the strategies, but just articulating the why of it is something I'd like to see a little bit more of.
Well, James Coe has plenty more on the site about all of that. And the other thing that James Coe has been thinking about and reading about this week is the Strategic Defence Review. Here's Jimbo.
Hello, it's James here, Associate Editor for Research and Innovation over at Wonky. Just dropping in to talk about Labour's Strategic Defence Review. For those of you less familiar with what a Strategic Defence Review is, it is Labour's articulation of how they will pull the policy levers to keep the country safe. It is interesting for those of us working in higher education, because not only is a plan about defence, it is ultimately a plan about the economy. And the plan is to spend a greater proportion of GDP on things like missiles and AI and artillery and cyber warfare. Every penny which is spent on defence is a penny that can't be spent elsewhere, which will ultimately mean, in the words of the IFS, chunky tax rises, or potentially cuts elsewhere. Richard Reeves believes that the defence spending will pay for itself in what she is calling military Keynesianism. You spend on defence and it generates surpluses elsewhere. If Richard Reeves believes this about defence, could it be the case that the Chancellor may see the case that spending can generate surpluses elsewhere, loosening her fiscal rules? This would be a boon for higher education, but let's not count on it. Elsewhere in the plan, there is words for universities in providing the skills that the country needs to secure our borders. There is a nod to research and trusted partnerships in shaping the research agenda. And ultimately, there is a place for universities in supporting this mission. It seems like the universities who can articulate their work about being the defence of the realm will do well. Those who cannot may see cuts to research elsewhere, as difficult funding decisions have to be made.
Now, finally this week, on the site, we've been thinking about academic pressure and our system in this country, particularly in England, of rapid graduate production. Really, what's the argument being made here?
Yes, thanks, Jim. So this really relates to the DfE's National Review of Higher Education Suicide Deaths, which I'm sure people have seen over the past couple of weeks. And the findings from the report showed that over a third of serious incidents that they reviewed made an explicit reference to academic pressure. And that, of course, relates to exams and assessment periods and so on. So, Jim, you, with your Wonky post, which I've seen that has got quite a bit of attention from readers, have invited us to think about whether part of the problem, this means the decline in student mental health and well-being in the UK compared to other European nations, relates to the fact that our students are enforced to study and complete their degrees too fast. And it is obviously true that our students tend to have lower dropout rates, but also faster enrollment to graduation rates. But I suppose the question here now for us is at what cost? Are we actually prioritising credentials over capabilities and student well-being? And I suppose the question close to my heart is that, is this what makes our students ill? So I suppose it's an interesting kind of thing to keep an eye on and think about. So I'm wondering what others think.
Mac, you'll notice one of the, and I think I've talked to you about this before actually, one, you know, when you're kind of reading all of the free text comments, when you get a bunch of data through, and you've allocated half an hour and 4 hours later, you're still reading the free text comments. You know that the standout quote in the, and I think I put this in the blog, while someone said, if workload is so important to UCU, why isn't it important to the SU? And I just thought that was kind of fascinating, because my sense is that although there's quite a bit of debate about assessment and the number of times we assess and assessment load, actually generally there's not much debate about workload in general.
There's something here about kind of the speed of the degree, right? It's so fast. It's 3 years for an undergrad or whatever, and it's compacted and compacted and compacted. And there's not really, there has always been problems with this, but it seems to be exacerbated now because there is no time in the middle to breathe, to do anything beyond your program and also survival, right? That everyone is so time poor, they're working 1,000 jobs, they've got care responsibilities, they're too far away from campus that their bus commute is so long. So there's no time to actually breathe in your programs. So there's no time to engage beyond just studying. And I think, I'm thinking about this in the context of DfE's, their kind of priorities for HE right now. And one part of this is kind of value for money, and another part of it is about the skills agenda. And it's all well and good, you know, wanting more and more STEM students or more and more students for their growth agenda. But those students aren't going to be any better than each other because they're all going to be burnt out, tired and unwell unless there is some more flex in that model for them to be more well-rounded, to get more experience. And you said there, Jim, about one of those free text comments which stood out to you. The one which stood out to me was, I think it was a computer science student in Denmark that said something like, there's no point speeding me up because then I don't have time to do my lifeguarding course or my this and that. And that was what really stood out to me was university isn't just that study program, it's everything that comes around it. And then if you keep pushing students through at the speed of sound, they're not going to have any time to develop those skills, those personal attributes, and at least that sort of personal sense of self, if there's no time to do it.
I mean, Jess, I guess in a tight fiscal context, one of the things that, I mean, even when Mac was just talking then, there was a part of my brain thinking, well, that sounds like a luxury. You know, that sounds like, you know, really nice to have when, you know, the world is burning. But at the same time, I was really struck by the PISA stats that basically show our graduates aren't as good as other graduates. Do you know what I mean? You know, we produce them. There's technically a European credit system, but their skills and their abilities are, you know, well below average.
I think I hate to disagree with you on your own podcast, Jim. I am not convinced that more time solves many of these problems. I think it feels nice to have, but I'm struggling, and I've sort of been reading through this, trying to like challenge my own priors. What does 4 years versus 3 years get you? It gets you, as Mac has just said, it gets you more time to think. It gets you to slow down some of the assessment, to sort of spend a bit more time on some of the teaching. But as you say, it also adds another year of cost, right? It adds another year of wondering about where you're going to live and how you're going to fund it and what job you're going to do. And there's a bit of me that thinks, as you say, again, it's the system we have, not the system you desire. It feels like there's a massive amount you would need to change, as already needs to be changed, all around sort of how we fund maintenance, how we think about accommodation, before you can see a world in which the 4 year undergraduate degree is the norm rather than the three, or even as a sort of European model where you just have a bit more optionality, right? Like you can pick to finish in 4 years rather than three, and you're in a bit more control of it. But this has been really interesting for me because my initial reaction was that's a mental idea, and then sort of as you and Mac have spoken about it, I'm sort of drawn a little bit more to thinking about, you know, are we, you know, people aren't dropping out, they are graduating, they're graduating with good degrees, but are we doing more harm than good along the way? I think I want a bit more time to think about.
I mean, really, the other thing, I didn't put this in the blog actually, one of my sort of, you know, drop the toast on the floor moments this year was at the Festival of Higher Education actually, and we'd got a student panel together, and one of the student officers, well, we hadn't planned this at all, one of the student officers said that her grandfather had died and she didn't have time to grieve. And when I was talking to her afterwards, she was saying, look, I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to drop out. I didn't want to repeat the year. I didn't want to, you know, pause the entire degree. I just wanted to do three modules instead of four so that I had a bit of time to. And, you know, the more diverse our student body gets, surely it means that we have to actually, for some students, offer the ability to get 180 credits done in 2 years at the same time as offering students the ability to get 180 credits done in 5 years, don't we?
No, and I see that in my work with students as well. Students are really struggling, despite the fact that they're doing well, you know, and that's the kind of, we can't, I think, equate the two in a way that students can be unwell, even if they're doing academically well. So yeah, I see that a lot. And students are speaking about, you know, using terms as toxic study cultures and all the rest of it. I suppose for me, there are two aspects to here. One is obviously the system. And I agree what Jess said in terms of if you purely thought about value for money, and if you purely thought about how the higher education is structured, there is no more space for for flexibility and so on, whether it's right or wrong. And that's the kind of sad bit. And I do think that contributes to students, you know, decline in mental health and well-being and pressures and so on. And then the other aspect to it, which, you know, I think we also need to acknowledge, is that students sometimes feed to each other as well. And it does become a culture of suffering to a certain extent. And I find it incredibly sad that, you know, the students that, you know, enter first year, many of them already have this enormous pressure on them, because that's part of how we almost package and sell university experience this day. It's going to be hard. You have to think about, you know, when we have an induction week, we already start preparing them for work. We start telling them, you know, whatever careers you have in mind. I mean, who in their right mind, you know, wants to think about those things when they have still, you know, 3-4 years ahead? So I think we are adding a lot of pressure on students themselves. And, you know, I had a really interesting project when I was looking at students on TikTok who give study advice to other students and make a lot of money out of it. But it was interesting that there is obviously students study together also, you know, online and so on, and watch those videos on how to do good essays and get good marks and so on. And then I had a conversation with a student who told me that, you know, Rilla, I feel that I'm not actually graduating from a particular university. I feel I'm graduating from TikTok, because most of the time that I'm now spending is on watching other people tell me how to, you know, get good marks and how to write essays and so on. So I think students feed on each other as well, and they add that extra pressure on, you know, you have to do well. And the costs are high. And, you know, I feel for students, because I think it's so much harder now than it used to be, despite the fact that there are many more opportunities. But yeah, so that's my kind of take on the speed. But
I mean, this is fascinating. I mean, here's a question for you, Mac, right? So the thing for me that I think is interesting here is, if, because our entrants are also pretty young, you know, by European averages. So, you know, there's a conveyor belt, isn't there? So you do your GCSEs, you do your A-levels, you go straight to university, and you need to get your degree done in 3 years. To some extent, what strikes me about that is there's never a moment over those, you know, 7, 8, whatever it is, years, where you're not with a year group cohort in competition with the rest of the year group cohort, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the result of that surely just means that you're constantly, either subtly or actually directly, depending on how the kind of markings it works on your module or whatever, you know, trying to keep up with everybody else.
Yeah.
And yet everything we know about adult learning tells us that people learn and need to learn at a different pace and a different speed, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think about, like, when you're at college or when you're at kind of sixth form, the thought of a gap year like terrifies every teacher in that room. And I remember, I mean, yeah, it's not that long ago for me, but people were talking about kind of study abroad. Thank God I didn't do it. There was the pandemic. But there was talks about study abroad, or like they would offer like a year in industry or an internship or whatever. And the first thought that me and most of my peers had was, well, that means we won't graduate with everybody else, or like we won't be on the same point, or they're all going to be in jobs and I'm going to still be at uni, like as if it's some sort of being held back sort of thing. And there's that whole culture. And I think this is also rooted as well in the language we use around, we're not taking a pause, we're not taking a break, we're not taking a breather, we're not cutting down to 3 modules so that we can grieve. We are taking an interruption. Like it's framed as a problem. It's framed as if something's gone wrong, as if the system isn't actually wrong in the first place. And from a student perspective, right, slowing down, correct, going, if let's say hypothetically I click my fingers and everyone goes to a 4-year course instead of a 3-year course tomorrow with the same amount of credits, students are going to be think that's not going to look like value for money anymore. Of course they are. And assuming that nothing changes about the student finance, they're going to pay another 9,535. There's two things here. There's one is about kind of how do you protect that? How do you protect that value for money? And how do you set expectations, i.e. that slowing down, there is value in it in all different ways that you can think about. But also, like, what we started off talking about, the health outcomes, like the safety part of this. It's not just like, will you develop better and will you have better knowledge? Actually, you will be healthier as a result of slowing down. And I was at a birthday party a few weeks ago, and this is really sad, but I was chatting to somebody who also works in HE, and I said, we've got the fastest graduates in the OECD and so on and so forth. And maybe I had too many glasses of wine, but I did say, look, if a 3-year undergrad was a physical activity measured on Strava or with a Garmin watch, it would say, this is high pressure, high intensity, avoid doing this activity because it's not good for you. And the stats tell us it's not good for you. So you would slow down. And look, I run a lot, so I would run at a slower pace. I would reduce the pressure on my knees. Like, that is just what you would do in the real world. So why we don't do it with education, God knows.
Well, here's a crunchy policy question for you, Jess. So one of the things about the LLE launch is that all the way through, whenever maintenance has been talked about, it's only ever been talked about as kind of in principle, right? And there's a crunchy reality coming, which is to still get full-time maintenance, either you'll have to enroll for 60 credits a year, or the government might announce less than that to still get full-time maintenance, or it will just take the maintenance package and divide it by credit. Now, what do you think they're going to do in the next few weeks? Because they have got to actually announce it at some point.
The most likely option, I think, is that they'll say you'd only get maintenance if you're doing the full 60 credits. And they'll just fling that out there and see what happens. Because I still think this is wrong, right? I disagree with it. The LLE is viewed as the option you do a bit alongside some other stuff while you're dipping your toe in the water of HE, but you've got a job and you don't need maintenance, or you're doing the big S student and you're doing it full time. So again, it sort of throws a spanner in the works, right, of the system that you and Max see that works really well in Europe, and the system I think we'd all like to see that's a bit more, I don't know if flexible is the right word anymore, just more options in it. You know, you can do it as a marathon or a sprint in a way that suits you. But yeah, from the policy terms, I can't see anyone, I'm sure there are people there and I would love to talk to them, who are thinking about the consequences of this, right? Like, if you have a system where you get a loan to do fewer credits, how do you pay for your life while you're doing them? Oh, we just expect you to get a job unless you're doing full time and you can't do it, in which case we'll give you some maintenance. That seems like the most likely place we're going to land. And I think all of us know that that's not going to work, right? You're not going to achieve its potential. But the other options are so expensive and so difficult and so complicated to work through that almost no one can be bothered by them. And I think it's thinking through the consequences of, again, if you're having a world where you want people to be able to study not just half time, but quarter time, what is the pay per credit you need to live and study and work all in one? And I don't know if anyone's worked that out yet.
But this is super interesting, right? So, like, forget quarter or half. Imagine it's 75, right? So imagine the government says, what we're going to do is chunk down the maintenance package by credit, right? So actually, I can see how some students who, for whatever reason, given, you know, complicated family or whatever, don't get that much maintenance loan entitlement, look at it and think, well, okay, I could do 45 credits this year rather than 60. I won't lose that much on an already paltry maintenance loan. But what that will enable me to do is do some serious full-time work alongside my studies that's relatively well paid, partly thanks to the increases in the minimum wage. And then in a way, maybe students will force some of this flexibility on the sector, do you think?
Super interesting, because, you know, Jim and Mackie, you've been traveling Europe, and I assume, have you visited Estonia as well, where I'm from? So an example from Estonia. So when I was a student, we had this dual track system where there was a certain number of state funded places and the rest paid. So that was kind of norm. Then 2013, there was a big reform, and all higher education taught in Estonian is free of charge for students. Now, that was an interesting shift, because I was doing some research and work with students at the time, or a couple of years, maybe 3-4 years later, when students were saying that actually they're really concerned, because in the past, what they could have had a much more flexible study. But now with this new system where you don't pay, you really have to keep up with credits. As soon as you miss a course or a deadline and so on, you start paying for whatever credits and you lose out and so on. And students were speaking about that, you know, with the past system, I could have combined with part-time work, because maintenance grants and so on are so low anyway, so there is no help. So I suppose that goes back to the whole question of we do need that flexibility built into the system, because otherwise, you know, what are we expecting from the students in that sense?
Yes, I guess students are just as likely to respond to funding incentives as anyone else. I mean, I guess the wider question, Mackie, is if, you know, there is a student mental health crisis. If we're not looking at flexibility, is it possible on the money that is now coming into HE and all the expectations on HE to sort of not fix this through slowing down, but actually to fix this through changes to the way we teach or assess, or changes to, you know, having more student support on campus, or, you know, improving belonging, all the things that people have been talking about? Have we got to kind of double down on making some of that stuff people have been talking about for a few years work?
I think it's everything, right? It's not just, we can't just slow down and expect student mental health to go up and to think that students can afford to spend more time studying. We can't just try and fix belonging with free academic societies for everybody, and we can't just hire more counsellors and think that all those problems will go away. You have to do everything at the same time and you have to do it well. And people listening will be like shivering and going, oh my God, we don't have any capacity for any of that. Yes, so far, I get that. But everything has to connect. Like every time we talk about kind of housing, then we're talking about financial health, and then we're talking about mental health, then we're talking about health outcomes, then we're talking about commuting. Like everything is so intrinsically connected that unfortunately, I think slowing down is one of the bigger causal mechanisms here. But I also think it needs to come with, you know, more comprehensive mental health support universities, which is incredibly hard right now with finances. But everything needs to be connected. And we can't get away from that without some sort of overhaul review, financial fees and funding and so on. So look, I'll talk about it all day and we'll get into a right rabbit hole, so I won't. But you know what I mean.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much, as ever, to Relay, Jess, Mac, Michael Salmon, who makes it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.